Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from Hyatt Ricky's Hotel in Palo Alto, California. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be your chair for this evening's program. I want to welcome the listeners of KLIV AM 1590 in San Jose, California. We also invite all of our listeners to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now let me introduce this evening's distinguished speaker. Following the U.S. engagement in Kosovo, there was an editorial cartoon that made the rounds. And it showed a number of experts on one of the panels on the nightly network discussion television programs. And the host was saying to the people on the panel, now tell us, you know, what you think about the war in Kosovo. And all of them were saying things like, it will never succeed without the introduction of ground troops. And they all had propellers on their heads. And it was sort of making fun of all of the prognostications and critiques that were made of the engagement in Kosovo, which in the end turned out not to be valid in the sense that the engagement did work without the introduction of ground troops. There, in addition to the various commentators, and I confess to having been one of those people on the nightly news programs talking about this, there were some much more serious and well-founded challenges to the U.S. engagement in Kosovo that were made during the time of the engagement. And probably the most serious and well thought out of those was that of Congressman Tom Campbell, who questioned and challenged the constitutionality of the use of U.S. ground forces in Kosovo without the appropriate congressional approval. Congressman Tom Campbell may possess the most impressive resume in the U.S. Congress. He was the editor of the Harvard Law Review, graduating from Harvard magna cum laude. After Harvard, he earned his Ph.D. in economics from the University of Chicago, and while there was awarded the highest fellowship in the Department of Economics. His dissertation was the first quantitative study of discrimination against women in the federal government. In his career, Congressman Campbell has been a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Byron White. He was a member of the White House Task Force on Women, chaired by Elizabeth Dole. He was elected to the House of Representatives in 1988 in the 12th Congressional District. In 1993, he was elected to the California State Senate in the 11th District. Congressman Campbell, in addition to his legislative career, has been a professor at Stanford University since 1983. He lectures on a variety of subjects, including international commercial law and economics, international jurisdiction, public international law, advanced antitrust, and the list goes on. In 1995, Congressman Campbell was again elected to the U.S. House of Representatives for California's 15th district, which includes Silicon Valley. As a member of the International Relations, Banking, and Joint Economic Congressional Committees, Tom Campbell is a legal expert on international, economic, administrative, and constitutional issues. Tonight, he will discuss a topic of great concern to him, as well as to many of us, the Kosovo engagement with an emphasis on U.S. international and constitutional law. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, the Honorable Tom Campbell.
What a lovely introduction. Thank you, Ms. Duffy. I'm so happy to be among friends. Many of you have been in my congressional district when I represented the 12th district, and many of you are in my congressional district as I represent the 15th, and it's many ways a homecoming. I also want to draw attention to my wife's presence here tonight, Suzanne Campbell. Suzanne is here. Thank you. That's kind of you. Suzanne is the director of the Berkeley Business School, a Haas Business School's program with St. Petersburg University. Suzanne is fluent in Russian, and she's been really the moving force behind this program to let Russians learn Western business, which was so critical as they came out of their socialist background. There were no free market economist-oriented business professors in Russia. And UC Berkeley deserves the credit for having established the program, and Suzanne deserves the credit for its success. There was a war in Yugoslavia. It lasted 79 days. The United States and most of its NATO allies conducted this war against Yugoslavia in the airspace above the province of Kosovo. The province of Kosovo is recognized by the United States as part of sovereign Yugoslavia. These are uncontestable facts, and yet they are the premise to, I think, any fair scholar or interpreter of the Constitution for the conclusion that the war was not conducted consistent with the United States Constitution. And that is my brief tonight. Although I'm happy for any questions that you might put to me, including the foreign policy of the war, I wished to spend our time in my prepared remarks dealing with the constitutionality of the war. This matter is pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, with oral arguments scheduled for October. The Constitution of the United States naturally is where we begin, and here is the relevant phrase in Article 1, Section 8, the Congress shall have the power. And then it lists a whole category after category compendium of powers which are exclusively given to Congress. Although the word exclusive does not appear, it is in that context that the following phrase appears: to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations, to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water, to raise and support armies. Why, therefore, is it important to worry about the words of the Constitution? Well, first of all, it is the Constitution. I took an oath to uphold and defend it, and it means something to me. It means something to me to raise my right hand and swear to God that I will follow what I said under oath. Second, it promises a more deliberate process, if you think about it, that we then not go into war unless we have convinced the people's representatives that it is desirable to do so. And the best proof of this is the founders themselves. I quote Hamilton, who spoke that war, certain interests, rather, are so delicate and momentous that entrusting them to the sole disposal of the president is unwise, Federalist 75. Abraham Lincoln, no one man should hold the power of bringing the oppression of war upon us, his letter to Herndon in 1848. Thomas Jefferson said that we need an effectual check to the dog of war. George Mason, I am for clogging rather than facilitating war. James Madison, war is among the greatest of national calamities, and urged that therefore it should be much more difficult to start it than to stop it. James Wilson was one of the finest, most keen observers and participants of the Constitutional Convention, and he said, this system will not hurry us into war. It is calculated to guard against it. It will not be in the power of a single man to involve us in such distress. For this important power of declaring war is vested in the legislature at large, and this declaration must be made with the concurrence of the House of Representatives. From this circumstance, we may draw a certain conclusion that nothing but our national interest can draw us into war. Those are compelling reasons, if we needed them, to obey the Constitution beyond the simple but very important fact that we did take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. There is as well a policy of importance to consider that if the action to go to war is approved by the people's representatives in Congress, we will show more staying power in the war in which we are engaged. I think this was made clear when the United States essentially got in and got out in Somalia under President Clinton and got in and got out in Lebanon under President Reagan. I am bipartisan, by the way, in my criticisms tonight. More than one president has violated the constitutional rules regarding the declaration of war, and they come from both parties. The possibility, rather, that we involve the people's representatives in Congress before a declaration of war would prevent our tenacity and our resolve from being called into doubt, as I think it was after Somalia and Lebanon. And secondly, and here's something that touches my heart with some depth, we are being fair to the men and women that we send into combat if we, the elected representatives, stand behind them. When I was debating this on the floor of the House, I was in charge of the time, and so I yielded time to various other members. And the one I most commonly yielded to and whose advice I most eagerly sought was Congressman Sam Johnson, 7 years a prisoner of war in Hanoi. And his hand is crippled to this day from the beatings that he took, and he walks with a limp, and he voted for my resolutions that this matter be brought to the Congress because, in paraphrasing his words, don't do to this generation of young men and women going into combat what was done to mine. Don't send them into battle without the support of the people's representatives. So from the point of view of a message to the world and a point of view of the United States itself, what we owe to our fighting men and women, it seems that we ought to abide by the Constitution. Well, what's the other argument? Why should we let it slide, assuming that our view of the oath of office was such that we could let it slide? The first argument is, well, since World War II, we've never declared war, so effectively it's fallen into disuse. Well, if that argument is right, then we'd still have separate but equal in our schools. That is to say that an error, a constitutional error having been committed, is no justification for it being continued. The United States Supreme Court has said, and I quote, that an unconstitutional action has been taken before surely does not render that same action any less unconstitutional at a later date. Well, a second argument is many wars, particularly going back even in history, have been fought by presidents without congressional approval, and so why should we begin to insist upon it now? This is a myth, and it's an interesting myth. I'm going to quote from a text written by Professor John Hart Ely, formerly a tenured professor at Yale University Law School, then at Harvard University Law School, then the dean of Stanford Law School. And he says in his book, War and Responsibility, to which, by the way, I owe a huge intellectual debt, and I wish to put that on the record. He says, quote, the original constitutional understanding was quite consistently honored from the framing of the Constitution until 1950. And when certain presidents did play a little fast and loose with congressional prerogatives, Polk at the start of the Mexican War, Wilson and Roosevelt, respectively, in the events leading up to the First and Second World Wars, they obscured or covered up the actual facts, pledging public fealty to the constitutional need for congressional authorization of military action. It is therefore impossible to build the occasional non-conforming presidential action of this period into an argument that they had gradually altered the constitutional plan. Shifts of constitutional power, to the extent they are possible at all, must be accomplished in the open. And in his research, which I'll go into later if you would like, he actually goes back to the very first, which is so often cited, the Barbary Pirates, the undeclared war about Napoleon. Even though there may not have been a declaration, there was an act of Congress authorizing the particular war. The reason, incidentally, is because we didn't have a standing army or navy in those days. And so it was necessary to get a bill through Congress to authorize the army or navy to conduct the action in question. So the overwhelming weight of the evidence is not as it has been quoted. Let me conclude on this one point with another quotation from Ely. Two careful and balanced volumes commissioned by the American Bar Association cover the period from 1776 to 1901. They strongly support the claim of general compliance throughout this period. So where does this argument come from that, oh, many, many wars were fought without congressional approval? Well, he has a very interesting and long discourse on this, and he analogizes it to Joseph McCarthy's list of 205 communists. And he could never find the 205 communists, but there was the list of the 205. In search of verisimilitude, see Joseph McCarthy's 205 communists working in the State Department, proponents of broad executive power often cite the exact number of congressionally unauthorized presidential military incursions in our history. The number varies from advocate to advocate, and, of course, with time. He cites, then, the fundamental study of the subject, which says that in 1967, the State Department compiled an official list of 137 instances where it asserted the president committed acts of war on his own authority. Careful scrutiny of the examples provided by the government belie this assertion. And I'd be happy to go further into it. Time doesn't permit, but let me tell you, makes remarkable reading in an iconoclastic way, because going into the subject, I had also thought, oh, well, sure, Congress simply never declared war or was involved in these early instances, and the truth is Congress was. The third argument is in favor of ignoring the words that the Congress shall declare war is, well, we're really not ignoring them. We're just vindicating that the Constitution also gives power to the president as commander-in-chief. So it's not that we're ignoring this provision of the Constitution. We're citing another provision of the Constitution. Well, first of all, that is the height of illogic. If it were true that the War Powers Clause, if the War Declaration Clause could be trumped by the Commander-in-Chief Clause, then why have the War Declaration Clause? In other words, if a commander-in-chief can initiate a war where there was no attack upon the United States, no attack on a United States ally, which was the case in Kosovo, then there's very little reason, it seems to me, to have the provision in the Constitution that the Congress shall declare war. The Federalist Papers give us the most clear expression of this at all, and it's telling to me that Hamilton wrote the following in Federalist 69, because it was Hamilton who most strongly vindicated the power of the executive. It was always Hamilton arguing that we will have a strong president and that that was going to be one of the reasons, the virtues of our new Constitution, one of the reasons to vote for it. And yet it was Hamilton who made this distinction between the president's role as commander-in-chief to prosecute a war and the role of Congress to declare it. Here is what he says in Federalist 69. The president is to be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. In this respect, his authority would be nominally the same with that of the King of Great Britain, but in substance, much inferior to it. It would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces, while that of the British King extends to the declaring of war and to the raising and regulating of fleets and armies, all which by the Constitution would appertain to the legislature. End quote, Federalist 69. There are two last arguments that are advanced in favor of the view to ignore the Constitution, and I'd like to consider them together. They are practical in their nature. The first of these is, well, if you give the president the authority to go into war, then you don't give an adversary time to grab hostages or other alliances time to form, which they would during the debate on going to war in the House and the Senate. And these are valid thoughts. For example, President Bush invaded Panama, in my view, also contrary to the Constitution. But had he waited, he argued, and debated the matter in the Congress, well, then there may have been hostages taken, American citizens in Panama. Or in Grenada, when President Reagan violated the Constitution to invade Grenada without the prior approval of Congress, the Soviet Union was still in existence, and it was a reasonable fear that the Soviet Union might then, had we been debating it for a couple of days or weeks, declared that it was in solidarity with Grenada, possibly through the intercession of Cuba. And then the second of the major arguments that's left is, well, as long as the president can threaten to go to war without the prior approval of Congress, then the possibility exists that we don't have to go to war. The threat alone will be enough to deter war. For example, Haiti, where President Clinton's threat to send in military troops was realistic and led to the change in the Cedras government. Well, there's two responses to this. It seems to me that the first point is that if these are virtues in the way that war is presently conducted, then I'm open to argument and we could amend the Constitution to change the way that this is done, if this is an overwhelmingly strong argument. The second and perhaps better response is Congress has on its own taken a step to recognize this, and that's the War Powers Resolution. In other words, it may well be that the original idea of having the Congress debate war and then the president carry out war is difficult in a world where hostages can be taken and alliances can form while Congress debates. But Congress can, of its own, within certain well-delineated boundaries, give power to the president, just as it has in the entire area of administrative law, the ICC, the FCC, the FTC, the CAB, all of the alphabet soup of Washington. What is it? It is delegated power from the legislature to the president He appoints the commissioners of these agencies. And here it was the War Powers Resolution, passed in 1973. Despite its name resolution, it is a statute, not a non-binding resolution. It was passed by over two-thirds of both House and Senate, and it was passed over the veto of President Nixon. It's a rough compromise, but it's the best answer I've got to these arguments that in the modern world there's a danger of having Congress debate because of hostages and alliances that can form. What the War Powers Resolution says is the president has 60 days, 60 days. He can go in, make use of a military armed forces of the United States, but within that 60-day period, he's got to bring the matter to Congress and get approved. And obviously, once the war is started, then there's no problem anymore about hostages or alliances. That risk you have the moment the war starts. The danger was during the time we were contemplating going into war, hostages would be taken or alliances formed. But once the president has started the war, all of those arguments are gone. And so in the War Powers Resolution, obviously falling on the heels of Vietnam, Congress ceded power to the president for the 60 days and said to the president essentially, you can do what you think is necessary, but surely whatever emergency there is, you can come to Congress and explain it and get our approval within 60. And if you don't, then you haven't made your case and you should withdraw. And you can take some extra time to withdraw safely. That's right there in the War Powers Resolution. What's the rebuttal of the president's supporters in this particular context who claim that the War Powers Resolution is not applicable? They say, first of all, that it is unconstitutional. If so, I'd just love them to agree to take the case to the Supreme Court so we can get a definitive judgment. I mean, that's not a cynical comment on my part. It's not a fatuous comment. It's a sincere comment. If it's unconstitutional because it invades too much the president's authority or it gives too much of the Congress's authority, it could be either one. Let's get it resolved, and if it is unconstitutional, let's get something else working here. Because right now we have a dead letter from the lack of adherence to the War Powers Resolution since 1973. The other rebuttal that I hear is the appropriations power can do this. No doubt you've heard this, and it was made by the president at the time of Kosovo. That's to say Congress can control whether we go to war or not by controlling appropriations. First of all, this is not allowed by the War Powers Resolution itself. The War Powers Resolution specifies that the appropriation shall not be construed as approval. So the Congress itself in 1973 saw this one coming, and in Section 8A of the War Powers Resolution, it says, no inference of approval shall be drawn from appropriations. Practically, that's logical as well. And the reason why was pointed out by the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington in a case called Mitchell versus Laird at the end of the Vietnam period. This court cannot be unmindful of what every schoolboy knows, that in voting to appropriate money, a congressman is not necessarily approving of the continuation of a war, no matter how specifically the appropriation refers to that war. A congressman wholly opposed to the war's commencement and continuation might nevertheless vote for the military appropriation, because he was unwilling to abandon without support men already fighting. And we actually heard that. Congressman Blagojevich, you might remember, an American of Serbian extraction from Illinois, who's a congressman and spoke against the war, nevertheless voted for the appropriation, saying that now that our soldiers are in combat flying these missions, what else can I do? And there's a practical matter, a third response. We have a pipeline so long in military expenditure that we really were not voting to appropriate money for Kosovo. There's $230 billion in the military pipeline every year. Believe me, there was money to spend in Kosovo. What we were voting for was to replenish that so that the next crisis that happens, we would be able to carry on military action. Should, God forbid, North Korea invade South Korea, we were spending the money to buy the weapons to replace those that were sent to Kosovo and not available for use in Korea. And lastly, and I think, at least in my judgment, overwhelmingly convincingly, look at the constitutional scheme. You heard my quotes from Madison and Hamilton and all the founders. They wanted to make it difficult to go to war, so they said you need the approval of both houses. What does that mean practically? It means one half of one house can stop war from being commenced. One half of one house, because it has to pass both houses. By contrast, if you say the Congress has this power through appropriations, You are saying, okay, you pass a bill appropriating money to the military with a rider saying none of this money may be used for Kosovo. The president vetoes it. And the only way to have it go into law is for two-thirds of both houses to pass it, thereby shifting what the constitutional framers intended, to have one half of one house prevent war, to say that it takes two-thirds of both houses to prevent war. That's a huge structural difference, and completely, I think, at least to me, completely convincingly rebuts the argument that we don't need this war powers resolution because Congress does still have a role to play through the appropriation process. And I note in concluding on the war powers resolution that the compromise really is one favorable to the president because it gives him those first 60 days. And there are many constitutional scholars who say that is too much of a gift of the war powers from the Congress to the president. In practice, I think what would have happened, by the way, had President Clinton come to the floor or asked to address a joint session of Congress, is that Congress would have approved the use of force in Kosovo. But I'm about to tell you what actually happened, and the result, I think, bore fruit from his decision not to and the position that he took that he didn't have to. To recap where we are, the practice from the founding of the Constitution up to 1950, the practice from the founding up to 1950 was to get congressional approval, despite the myth to the contrary. Korea and Vietnam were major departures. In the wake of Vietnam, Congress passed a compromise called the War Powers Resolution. And ever since, the only exception that has ever occurred to abiding by the War Powers Resolution is Kosovo. Every other use of force has taken less than 60 days, with the exception of Desert Storm, and there President Bush got approval of Congress. Hence, Kosovo presents the ideal test case of the Constitution and the War Powers Resolution. I wish to be concerned about time, and I hope that I'm not going too long, but I've got another few points to raise. So I'm going to look over to you for disapproval, and I won't look frequently. So what happened in Kosovo? The administration took the position from the start, up to and well past the 60th day, that there was no need for congressional approval. That was the position that they took. When I asked, I was told by representatives of the State Department that they would not even need approval to send in ground troops. That was the statement they made to the House International Relations Committee. Instead, and I'm going to use the word advisedly, members of the administration prevaricated, and that put them in a very bad light. Recall that the word hostilities is in the War Powers Resolution. It says that the president may not put United States armed forces into hostilities for longer than 60 days without the approval of Congress. When Secretary Albright came to testify before the International Relations Committee, I asked her, Madam Secretary, are we at war in Kosovo? And she says, we're not at war. I said to her, I wish to be fair to you. I want to tell you why I'm going to ask the next question. And then I cited the War Powers Resolution about hostilities. And I said, are we engaged in hostilities in Kosovo? And her answer was remarkable, disappointing. She said to me, you are a professor of law. I am a professor of political science, and I will not help you with your field. That was her answer. And it is, to me, disappointing that the Secretary of State would not tell the representatives of the people elected on the relevant committee whether we're putting our men and women into hostilities. Shortly thereafter, the Assistant Secretary of State testified, and I asked her, are we at war? And she said, no. I said, are we in hostilities? And she said, no. I said, what are we in then? She said, armed conflict. I said, what is the difference between hostilities, war, and armed conflict, particularly to somebody underneath the bombs that are falling? And I'm not making this up. She said, wait a minute, I brought the attorney from the State Department, and he will answer that. So the gentleman from the legal advisor to the Secretary of State came up and took the witness stand, the witness chair, and he said that the difference between hostilities and war and armed conflict is if the president does it without getting the approval of Congress, it is armed conflict, and if he gets the approval of Congress, well, then it's hostilities or war. The answer that they gave, both the Secretary of State and her assistant, was ignorant I use the word again, just factually and not hopefully unfairly, ignorant of the following legislative history of how the word hostilities got into the War Powers Resolution, and I quote from the House report in 1973. The word hostilities was substituted for the word armed conflict during the subcommittee drafting process because it was because it was considered to be somewhat broader in scope. So by admitting armed conflict, they had admitted hostilities. Meantime, Secretary Cohen deserves credit for being a touch more candid. In testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee on April 15th, he stated, quote, "We're certainly engaged in hostilities. We're engaged in combat. Whether that measures up to, quote, a classic definition of war, I'm not qualified to say," end quote. I just note in passing that the Secretary of Defense used to be called Secretary of War. But he tells us he was not qualified to say whether we were in war or not. And should proof further than that be needed, the reality of what was going on I don't think is difficult for a court or for any fair reading of the reader of the Constitution to conclude we were engaged in war. As of the time we filed our brief, which is relevant because that's when we filed our case and our brief supporting, 20,000 sorties had already been flown, 9,000 bombs had dropped over 1,900 Yugoslav targets. We had called up 33,102 reservists. General Ralston, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had stated that the military's operation over Kosovo is a major war theater. We had authorized combat pay retroactive to the start of the armed conflict. As a general rule in public life, don't defend the indefensible. Don't say it's not war when it's war. Don't say that you have a principal distinction between armed conflict and hostilities when you don't. You make yourself look weak. And for those who took the other side on the merits, and I respect them, their side was diminished by prevarications of this kind. Those who took the other side on the merits should have said, yes, it's war, and here's why we should be in it, and then brought it to the House as President Bush did relative to Desert Storm. And I put to you that their failure to do so and their engagement engaging instead in the use of words, manipulation of words, hurt their cause. So my first point in our lawsuit is that war was actually what was happening, and therefore the Congress had to declare it. The second part of my argument was, whatever it was, come the 60th day, the troops had to come out because Congress had not affirmatively voted in favor of it. Hostilities certainly existed. And those two premises I took to the court. Before doing so, I asked for a vote in the House of Representatives. And the reason I asked for the vote was because in the 1991 buildup to Desert Storm, Congressman Ron Dellums had brought a lawsuit against President George Bush. You might remember this. He argued that Desert Shield violated the Constitution. That was the putting of troops in Saudi Arabia preparatory to the actual Desert Storm. And, of course, President Bush had not then come to Congress. So the case went to the court, and the court ruled that Ron Dellums would not be able to bring his lawsuit because it was not yet ripe. Remember the word ripe, because I'm going to come back to overripe in a moment. And the reason it was not ripe was because there had not been a vote in the House of Representatives or the Congress. That was his argument, the argument the court gave to Ron Dellums. Accordingly, I used the provisions of the War Powers Resolution to bring to the floor the two options that that law permits. And let me just say the reason is that an ordinary average member of Congress, which is all I claim to be, cannot get a vote on the House floor simply by standing up and demanding it. Rather, you need to have the Rules Committee saying so. But for the War Powers Resolution, the War Powers Resolution has a most wonderful provision saying that when a member of Congress believes that its provisions are being violated, he or she may get a vote on the House floor on one of two resolutions, a vote to declare war or a vote to withdraw the troops as quickly as their safety allows. Regrettably, I couldn't put anything in between. So I brought those two resolutions, to declare war on Yugoslavia. I'm the author of the first declaration of war resolution since the early days of 1942, and to withdraw the troops, and I brought them both. I then invited, not that I'm listened to, but formally invited the President and the Secretary of State to give any resolution they'd like, anything they'd like, so we could vote on what they'd prefer, their language. I wasn't going to put words in their mouth. The President and Secretary of State declined. And so I went to the Speaker of the House and said, would you please allow an alternative and give the Democratic leadership the right to draft it? So Dick Gephardt did, and his resolution was to approve the President's use of force. And lastly, Congressman Goodling put in a resolution which they permitted a vote on, which they permitted a vote to say that whatever's going on now, no ground troops without the approval of Congress. On April 28th, the vote was 2-427 against declaring war. The vote to approve the Gephardt resolution, to approve what the President was doing, failed 213-213. Evenly divided vote. And I'll say tonight what I've said many times before. Had the President and the Secretary of State chosen to lobby, recognized that they needed to get congressional approval, surely one person's point of view could have been changed. This vote is a direct result of the posture taken by the President and Secretary of State that they did not need to come to the Congress. My resolution to withdraw within 30 days failed, 139-290. And the resolution to get approval of Congress before the ground war starts carried 249-180. Accordingly, my case was ripe, and 2 days later, I brought it to the Federal District Court. 31 plaintiffs, 28 Republicans, 3 Democrats. The Democrats were Kaptur of Ohio, Kucinich of Ohio, and Pete Stark of East Bay. Amicus Curiae, 10 constitutional law professors filed a brief amicus curiae on our side, including Larry Tribe of Harvard Law School, whom I mention because he is frequently referred to as a liberal constitutional law professor and frequently spoken of as favoring the administration, including John Hart Ely, who authored this book, including Jerry Gunther of Stanford. The court ruled against us on June 8th. It said that I had no standing because the Congress had voted to appropriate funds and the Congress had failed to vote to withdraw. And here this flies directly in the face that the War Powers Resolution says you shall not use an appropriation to infer that Congress has approved or failed to approve. And as far as the vote to fail to withdraw, look, if I'm right about my theory that Congress has to vote first, the failure of Congress to do anything doesn't matter one way or the other, because Congress wins if it does nothing. The President does not have the authority. You should not, therefore, stop a congressperson from bringing the lawsuit for anything that Congress fails to do when inaction is all that the Constitution requires to stop war from happening. To conclude, if a constitutional claim is right, it should have been heard. 4 days after the district court ruled against us, the bombing ended. We filed our appeal in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and now I get to use the word overripe. The President's attorneys now argue that the case is moot because the war is over. What it comes down to is practically this. Should the Constitution provision of declaration of war and provision of commander-in-chief be tested in the Supreme Court? The courts can choose to dodge it. They can say it's not yet ripe and it's overripe. It's not, you don't have standing, but somebody else might. They can dodge, but I think they are not living up to their opportunity to do so. And it seems to me that the obligation, which I felt as a member of Congress, to stand up on the floor and ask for a vote on war, and the obligation the President of the United States felt as Commander-in-Chief to conduct a war that he believed in, are both deserving of credit. Different policies. And I can certainly be wrong on my constitutional arguments. But what is to me not defensible is for the third branch of government not to do its job. What is the purpose, if not that the third branch will adjudicate differences between the first and second of this gravity, of this importance, so that we can amend this process if it is not functioning? There's a personal note with which I conclude. I've mentioned John Hart Ely a number of times, the author of this fine volume on war and responsibility. He was my constitutional law professor at Harvard. He then was the dean at Stanford who hired me to join the faculty at Stanford Law School. And I came to Stanford Law School because John Hart Ely offered me the job. And coming to Stanford allowed me to represent the wonderful people of the Bay Area in Congress a few years thereafter. I'm a native Chicagoan, an immigrant to California. And I don't think a Republican would have been elected in Hyde Park, Illinois, around the University of Chicago. John Ely did a conclusion in his book referring to how sad it was that this most important issue had never been resolved. And on the cover of the book is the wall with the names of men and women of my generation, whom I believe everyone in this room knows or knows of a family who had a member. What we owe to them is to do our duty, whether it is to conduct a war as the president thinks was right by his lights, or to insist that a vote happen in the House and Senate by my lights, but it is time for the courts to do theirs. I was pleased that they've set oral argument for October 10th. I hope that they take the case under the theory of administrative law that even if a case is technically moot, if it is capable of repetition yet evading review because it is so short in duration, courts will take it. And that, I think, fits this case like a glove. John Ely says about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, 90 senators were present, 88 voted aye, only Wayne Morse and Ernest Gruening voted nay. Each was defeated for re-election the next time he ran. The resolution had earlier passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 416-0. And I thought when I read those words, there was Congress doing the easy thing. Just give it to the president. That was the Gulf of Tonkin. Just give it to the president. And that if it ever came that I had the chance, I would not look the other way, that I owed it to the generation whose names are on the wall. Thank you for your kind attention.
Our thanks to Congressman Tom Campbell for his extremely cogent and well-argued case. And now we're going to turn to Bob Keeve, president of Empire Broadcasting, to do the questions and answers. Bob?
Thank you to our chairman of this evening, Gloria Duffy. Congressman, we've gotten some very, very provocative questions, and I've had trouble sorting them out. I'll start with a tough one, okay? Is the failure to abide by the War Powers Resolution an impeachable offense?
If the Supreme Court of the United States rules that the War Powers Resolution is constitutional, then failing to abide by the law is an impeachable offense. It would be, in my judgment, a high crime and misdemeanor. The president is, however, within his rights to contest the constitutionality of the statute and take it up to the Supreme Court and argue against me. So prior to the ruling by the United States Supreme Court, I do not think it is an impeachable offense. But if the Supreme Court makes that ruling, then it would be analogous to President Nixon, who was ordered by the Supreme Court of the United States to turn over the tapes. Had he refused to do so, that would have been an impeachable offense. So also here.
Shouldn't concern for halting ethnic cleansing and concern for insistence on morality and decency take priority over legal interpretation?
I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. I did not swear to be smart, insightful, compassionate, or just. I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution. That's the one thing I swore to do. Same with the president. Same with every state legislator, same with every official under our constitutional scheme. So the answer is as strong as I possibly can make it, absolutely not. And legalisms is a pejorative for abiding by the Constitution. It is not a legalism to say that separate but equal violates the heart and soul of the 14th Amendment. Would we say that, you know, let it go a little bit longer, it's okay to have segregated schools because, you know, it's going to be a huge problem once we start this. How do you do it? You got busing going on? I hope I've proved my point that the most important thing is what you swore to do. Secondly, I think there's a very good case to be made the other way. I mean, on the merits of going into Kosovo, not on the Constitution. I do not, with respect, see the other side on the constitutionality, but so the president should have brought the case to Congress. For heaven's sakes, it was 213 to 213. And he chose not to participate in the debate. He chose to have a Secretary of State tell me that I'm a professor of law, so I won't help you with your field. He had his Assistant Secretary of State say that it was armed conflict but not hostilities. If the compassion and concern for ethnic cleansing or genocide, if it were genocide, is a compelling argument, then it could have convinced the American people's representatives. And I submit to you that if he could not have convinced the American people's representatives, then he didn't have the case he thought he had.
Are the issues surrounding the legality of engagement different for you when the action is initiated by the United Nations?
As a matter of United States constitutional law, no. The accession to the United Nations document that was passed by the United States Senate, there was the United Nations Accession Act as well as the actual UN treaty, clearly specified that the contribution of forces to the Security Council was subject to the domestic law of the United States, and that the Senate and the House were not waiving their constitutional rights. So the answer is quite clear. Imagine if it were otherwise. I mean, as a legal point, imagine that a treaty could trump the Constitution. Would a treaty with South Africa 20 years ago have allowed us to have race distinctions? No, obviously not. So the Constitution wins even over a treaty, but in point of fact, the UN treaty incorporates the reality that the use of force has to be approved by the domestic law of each country, and the document that passed our Senate said it in so many words. The point is a very good one, however, when we deal with the other subject, which we did not get into tonight, which is worthy of another meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley chapter, and that is, under international law, what premise does it take before you go in? Because normally the rule under international law is don't violate somebody else's borders. And yet we're willing to make exceptions for that. For genocide, we should. I mean, everyone in the room would agree. Had we been able to stop Hitler from killing the Jews in Germany, we would have, and it wouldn't have been asked, well, wait a minute, he hasn't yet invaded Poland. So that's the distinction. It's a difficult one. And one way around that is if the United Nations acts, it then lends international imprimatur to such action. And I conclude by observing that the United Nations, of course, did not act prior to our going into Kosovo. We instead claim to have authority from NATO, but NATO is not the UN, and not that I believe there's any equivalence morally. But to an average citizen of the formerly Soviet Union, to say NATO approved it, hence it's okay with international law, sounds as strange to their ears as for us to say the Warsaw Pact approved the invasion of Czechoslovakia.
Here's a question that really has a variety of questions to it. The person says, I agree with your position on the illegality of the war in Yugoslavia, but how can you explain a party line vote on that issue or on the impeachment of President Clinton, a plague on both houses, he adds, or she adds, isn't it time for a third party? So you have about three questions there.
I give credit to every member that she or he voted his or her conscience on war and on impeachment. I don't stand here and say that if you didn't vote the way I did, you're morally corrupt. I think you give it your best judgment, and some agreed and some disagreed. As to the party line on the war, I will say that I'm proud of the Democrats who are plaintiffs with me in this, and I'm proud of the Republicans who joined Ron Dellums in his lawsuit. There is bipartisanship on this issue, even though the huge majorities of each party did go separate ways. So much for the war. On impeachment, I repeat what I said about the merits and people living by their own conscience, but I would put a suggestion to you that every member of the House knew at the time going in that unless you were in a solid Republican district, a vote to impeach the president would hurt you politically. I knew that. I know that. I cast the vote that my conscience required on the basis of evidence that the president had not told the truth in a federal criminal grand jury after lifting his right hand, swearing to God Almighty that he was going to, and that he rehearsed other people not to tell the truth by going over their testimony with them. That is what I believed, and that I thought was sufficient that he should not be our leader. Other people came to a different conclusion. I respect it, but I suggest to you that the numbers of people who knew that they were casting votes that would hurt them by voting to impeach far outnumbered those who were casting votes to acquit or to fail to impeach and knew it would hurt them. I'm just saying that as a matter of real politic. There was very little repercussion if you're in a close district from voting not to impeach, whereas there is huge repercussion the other way, which I welcome and which, on the merits of which I'm prepared to make my defense. George Shultz put it best, I thought. He said that partisanship is when you do what is not in the best interest of the country in order to advance a political cause. In the case of impeachment, the Republicans hurt their political cause. And I'm telling you that I knew what I was doing, and so did my colleagues. I simply could not do otherwise. And as to third party, I've thought of it. Many people have thought of it because I don't fit perfectly in any party. Neither does anyone in this room. I mean, it's an amazing exercise, is it not, to create a party platform and then suggest that that is what every Democrat believes and every Republican believes? Each one of us departs from the party platform. Here I'll draw a little bit on my economics background to suggest that there is a principle, though, of a stable equilibrium. And two parties is a stable equilibrium in America. The third party almost always hurts the candidate of the major parties who they intended to be most similar to, pardon my grammar, and that's proved from Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose to Ross Perot, who, in my judgment, handed the election to President Clinton and took it from President Bush because he thought President Bush wasn't being tough enough on the budget. And so similarly, the problem with the third party is you destabilize a stable equilibrium and you always hurt the party closest to you.
I wonder how you'd feel, Congressman, if we changed the subject, because there's some people out there who asked other questions. What is your stand, one of your members of your audience asks, on the repeal of the death tax and the repeal of the inheritance tax?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Give this one nanosecond's reflection. Who pays the death tax? People who have not spent everything in their life. Not really them, actually. It's their widows and orphans. Think of it for a moment. You couldn't design a more perfect tax on those people who save and invest. Because the only way to avoid the death tax is to have spend it all. It is hugely bad economics. I think its origin is understandable. There was a sense, particularly in the wake of the Depression, that accumulations of wealth had to be spread out among the people of the country. But its economics is absolutely cockamamie. It raises less than 1% of the revenue of the United States. It wreaks havoc upon family farms and small businesses. And I think it should be phased out. You said the inheritance tax and the death tax, they are the same thing. Perhaps the questioner was dealing with the marriage penalty. That's the other aspect that I frequently get asked on. And as to that, I don't think the government should tax you differently if you're married or single, black or white, male or female.
This question says, since you were the principal force behind the proposition to change to the open primary because you felt that it would have enabled you to win the 1992 Senate election, that's what it says, and presumably would have secured a victory the next time, everyone expected you to run. Why didn't you?
Well, shall I respond to the premise of the question? In 1995, I was privileged to be elected to represent the people of the 15th District, Silicon Valley South, San Jose, Saratoga, Los Gatos, Santa Clara, Montesereno. If I ignore one, you know, neglect one now, I'm in serious trouble. Coming over 17 into Scotts Valley, Ben Lomond, Felton, Boulder Creek, San Lorenzo Valley. And I promised, and Lordy, I know I've missed one. And I was asked in the hotly contested election, wasn't I really just running in order to get myself back into Congress so I could run against Senator Barbara Boxer? And that was a fair question to ask, and I said, no, I'm not. And they said, well, then will you promise that you won't run against Senator Barbara Boxer in 1998? And so I said, all right, that is what I promise I will do. And what happened, of course, was Susan Golding was the person I endorsed, the mayor of San Diego, a moderate Republican, a fine candidate, who then withdrew 3 weeks before the filing closure. And we were left with two conservatives and no moderate, which was a dream, a gift from heaven for a moderate Republican to win a primary. And I remembered my word, and I kept my word. That's why I did not run in 1998. I had promised I would not. And so I don't know what life presents with me, but at least won't present me with a memory of having broken my word for opportunism. And as to the open primary, it wasn't for helping me. I was delighted to be involved in making it the law of our state. The purpose was very direct, this. What you want is the best people to run. Politics should not be to support the interests of a political party, but the interests of the people. And you get the best candidates if you get people running who don't have to get to the far left to win the Democratic nomination and don't have to get to the far right to win the Republican nomination. But those two screens being what they are today, I am troubled that we then end up at election time with two alternatives as to whom I have heard people say the choice of two evils. If instead you have an open primary, the Republican has to be a little bit more moderate, maybe a little bit more socially moderate, maybe not insisting so much on social conservatism. And the Democrat has to be a little bit more cognizant of the means of creating wealth, which leads to the jobs and the opportunity that our society provides. And I think the state is better for it.
Well, I'm afraid that our time has just about run out, so we have time for one more question, but I'm going to make this two questions in one, Congressman, if I could. One person says, will California ever elect a liberal Republican senator from the northern part of the state? And another person says, and this is a lot of editorializing, would you consider running for the Senate? We'll support you, he says.
Bob, thanks for the kindness in putting those questions last. And I want to respond that the introduction was particularly kind because did you notice how the introduction elided from my service in Congress to running for the state Senate as though I was in Congress and suddenly decided, you know, I'd like to be a state senator, so I'll give up the House of Representatives and just hope Becky Morgan retires. The intervening event, as most people know, is that I did run and I did lose in the Republican primary in 1992, and I have thought that someday I might have the chance to run again. The open primary certainly makes that more possible because I believe that it will draw voters to the polls, including those who are not officially in a party, who might find appealing a message that I hope to present in terms of a socially moderate point of view and a fiscally conservative one. I note, by the way, lest this be entirely self-serving, that very good Democratic candidates are increasingly putting forward that mixture as well. The whole movement of the Democratic Leadership Council within the Democratic Party was for that purpose. And so with that happening, I think the drift is favorable. What I do in the near future, I have not decided. It is a subject of intense discussion around our home in San Jose. And I will say that I'm privileged and honored to have a home in San Jose and to know that I'm representing people of that great district. And to serve in that capacity is really a tremendous honor. If I never run for any other office than the United States House of Representatives, what a tremendous honor. What a gift. What a gift to be one that stands on the floor of the House and gets to make a motion. What a gift to think that I might represent some of the brightest, most involved, public-spirited people our country has to offer, and certainly the people who are responsible for our economic growth over the last decade. So if nothing further comes from that, I am very privileged to be United States Congressman. And thank you for your attendance tonight.
Well, our thanks to Congressman Tom Campbell, and we'll all be watching carefully and with interest to see what happens on October 10th and thereafter. And our thanks to Bob Keeve of Empire Broadcasting for doing the questions and answers. Thank you all for attending this evening, and now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.